Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 266. Thank you for tuning in, guys. I have a request of you. This podcast episode is one of my all-time favourites. It's one of the best I've ever done. I'm really proud of it. Tim gives some amazing insights. He kind of opened me up on some things that I wasn't necessarily expecting. So that was cool and scary. I speak about some stuff I've never spoken about to anyone in the world ever before in this episode. So it goes kind of deep and kind of heavy. And it's some mental health stuff. But the reason I need your guys' help is this episode, as said, honestly, you know I don't say all the time that it's one of my it's my favourite in a while. It's dropped on a week where, for another thing that I'll talk about another time, I have to not go on social media for a week. I'm kind of undecided at the moment of what I'm going to do. I might send someone else on to just do a post about this podcast, because I don't want to not post about it, because, as said, it's one of my favourites of all time, but I also know that and Tim knows, Tim Clare isn't this huge name. So if people are just browsing on iTunes or Acast or Spotify, then they might see that when I go, I don't know who that is. I'll go on to another thing. So I really just need you guys to spread the word if you can, like, more than ever. Like, have a listen, but I think you're going to listen and go, man, that's one of the best that we've had. Tim's enthusiasm and his knowledge, it's fantastic. This episode means the world to me, so it's annoying. I'll be back online at some point on Friday, so I'll try and shout about it then. But also on Sunday, I've got a bonus episode because it's Emmy Awareness Day. And I sat down with Jason Reed, who has Emmy, and we talk about Emmy and how misunderstood it is as an illness or as a condition. So, yeah, it's kind of tough. I've not got tons of time to push this. So, yeah, I don't normally do this. Often if it's a mental health one or whatever, or a smaller name, I'll ask you to give it a push. But you know I don't normally go in this heavy and this deep to ask you to spread the word on this. So, yeah, if you could, it'd be really appreciated. I mean, there's a lot on here advising on overcoming procrastination, overcoming writer's block, increasing your productivity. So if there's any chat groups, any Facebook groups that this would be a relevant one for people to listen to, then, you know, go and post it in there and spread the word. As I said, it's weird. This is the longest intro I've ever given for trying to get you to share one, but I think you're going to have a listen. You're going to understand why. Tim was, as I said, unbelievably open, but he also brought an openness out in me that I wasn't expecting on the day. And yeah, it's a great chat. And I'm just a fan of Tim Clare anyway. It was good to have a catch up. I love the dude. We plug a lot of things in the show at the end of the show, or the main things that need plugging. Things like his Death of a Thousand Cuts podcast, which is a Couch 280K thing. It's chatting to a lot of authors and different people in there. Anyway, I'm going to get on with the podcast. I'm going to skim over all the plugs, because that bit at the beginning was the important bit for me. Obviously, speechdevelopmentrecords.com is where you can buy stuff. Obviously, patreon.com/scroobiuspip. We've just had Poem of the Month, and me and Tim talk about being on the spoken word scene together. This month's poem is one that I may have performed around the time me and Tim were doing stuff. But yeah, anyway, that's all there. It's $1 a month. It's not very much. Let's get on with the podcast. I'll be back at the end. Also, you know, it's key to mention that we've got a special at the weekend as well. On with the podcast. This is episode 266 with the wonderful Tim Clare.
This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is distraction pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to the distraction pieces.
Yeah, I say it all the time, but genuinely mean it. There's no one that gets more out of these podcasts than me. And knowing a lot of the stuff that you've devised, a lot of the things that you've researched, it's all stuff that I've hit walls with in recent years and things like that. And I've wanted to have a chat with you about and things like that. So when we was like, let's just do a podcast, that's far easier.
That's great. I'm excited.
It's perfect. So I'm joined today by Tim Clare. How are you, sir?
I'm feeling really, really good. I had a cold shower before you came around, not because it was specifically you, but because I was up at 5:45 this morning. So I was like, I've got to wake myself up. So yeah. I got under the cold shower and I feel awake.
I'm such a big advocate for cold showers. I've, for over a year now, more cold showers than hot showers. I have one after every time I exercise, and I've got really into my exercise. Even if it's a light exercise, I like it. I feel I'm in a better place mentally when I'm exercising and stuff like that. And the times I'm in a rougher place is when I've not had time to exercise and things like that. But I had Wim Hof on the podcast, and he talked to me about the power of cold showers, and I'd already heard his stuff before. And I just started doing it after exercise, and it stopped me getting any aches or pains or anything getting caught or knots or sticking. But then after a while, I'd miss them if I wasn't having them, as stupid as it sounds. At first, I'd be like, I need to get through it. It's good for me. Then it'd become a treat. And then I'd have a week where I'm not exercising and I'm just having normal warm showers. And I'd be like, I really want that buzz of being burnt out from exercise and then a cold shower to hit you through.
It's so difficult to explain that desire to go under a cold shower to people with. I didn't mention I was doing it to anyone for months because I was so convinced they'd look at me like I was like, you know, like drinking squirrel wee or something. Yeah. I genuinely thought they'd think I was being like bro science dude and going like, 100%. I'm going in and I'm like, just by the way, so you know, yeah. I get up every morning and because I'm like disciplined, I'm having cold showers.
Yeah.
And I was so scared that people would think that I was just doing it to show off.
Yeah.
I'm like, nobody's there. The first time I did it, I was in the shower in there and I'm so glad no one was in the house because I screamed. Like, it is horrible the first time
Mate,
you do
the
it.
The first time I did it, I was speaking to my mum on the phone and I genuinely felt I'd pulled a muscle, not from the exercise I'd done, but from the little tensed face I did as the cold water hit me. So I'd been exercising hard, nothing. I get in the shower and because you do that little tense neck thing, I was like, oh, God, I've pulled a muscle from the cold shower. But yeah, exactly. That first time, it's horrendous. But
it does get
addictive.
Lovely.
And it will be the endorphins or whatever else it sets off in you. Again, I'm bro-sciencing it up now. But it does that.
I love it. And I think, you know, like, I don't know how you are with, like, your sort of mental health and anxiety. But for me, and we can get into this a bit later, but for, I think... So, like, I heard sort of one thing that Marc Maron talked about a lot, like with comedians, is like a lot of people get into comedy because they want to choose the reason, control the reason why people laugh at them, right? They were bullied at school.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, one of the things that cold showers let me do is like choose the reason why I feel anxiety and choose the reason why I am feeling nervous. Like, it allows me, it gives me like this little control box where it goes, you know, like feeling horrible or feeling that anticipation, feeling your heart starting to beat, feeling like the amygdala, that little sort of like almond shaped bit in your brain starting to react and go, there's a threat coming, and you know there isn't because it's just some water coming out of a shower head and it's like the least, we're not like wrestling a tiger. It's a shower. Nothing bad's going to happen to you. So you just get to experience those things in a controlled environment and go, okay, how am I going to deal with this? Because you get to see the whole fight or flight or freeze response happening. This is your choice and you know it's for no reason.
But equally, you've got the option to jump out. Yeah. So that is it. There is the fight or flight thing there still. Even though it's a minuscule one, it's still there. It's that. Yeah, it's putting yourself in that
situation. And you're right, the choice is really important because, like, pouring freezing water on is, like, how they induce stress in, like, lab rats and stuff, yeah, right? Yeah. But those lab rats didn't get a choice. This is something that definitely, and I think it's really important with all of these things to be like, there are people who have no control over suffering, like chronic pain and things like that. And, you know, they're not going, oh, this is a great opportunity for me to learn about myself. Although, you know, all these things can be, but I think it's that fact that it's voluntary makes a huge difference, right? Because you're getting to choose it and you're getting to do it on your own terms. And so many of the things that go wrong in our lives or the things that cause us stress feel like they're completely out of our control. So I guess, you know, that's, but I love, do you, Wim Hof as well, he's got such like a kind of like, slightly kind of like manic, kind of like uncle voice, you know, he seems like such like an, so I imagine like, it's easier to get into a shower feeling like that he'd be proud of you a little bit.
Yeah, oh, completely. The time I had him on the podcast, I got to go to his house in Holland, and he was just, and there's so much of his stuff that I think is absolute hippie bullshit, but I think mixed in there's some amazing science, even just as said, psychological stuff, some amazing things in there, and it's finding that balance, because again, I think we're so quick to be so binary with things that these days, it's right or wrong. And Joe Rogan's a prime example. Wim Hof, all of these different people say, yeah, but he said this and that's bullshit. It's like, all right, but how about all this other stuff that maybe isn't? It's like, there doesn't have to be that they're right, or no one is right on everything or wrong on everything. It's kind of, it's not how it is. So I loved developing that in me, I guess, as a person to go. I sat there with Wim, and for loads of it, I'm sitting thinking, mate, what are you even talking about? But then because I'd had someone like Dan Hardy on, who's an MMA fighter who I love dearly, and he got really into crystals, and I think they're nonsense, but I know Dan is intelligent, articulate, a wonderful human. So that kind of was a real door opener for me, I guess, as a human to go, well, we don't have to agree on everything, but that doesn't write someone off just because they believe in this or
it's
that.
Sometimes I think people think that's a slightly sort of, these days, maybe they don't, but I always fear that people feel that's like a flaky position. But like, I remember going, when I was sort of starting out in poetry, I made myself do 2 months where I left home and did 2 months on the road, going to a different open mic every single night.
Love
for
it.
2 months. And one of them was at lunchtime up in Glasgow with a poetry group that turned out that had originally been a recovering from the mental health system group. And there was a woman there who, like, she'd just been on a course where she did sort of like psychically bonded with horses and was telling me about like how, what the horse had been thinking and how she, and I don't believe, my understanding of the universe is such that I do not believe that is possible, or I have no reason to believe that is possible. But at some point during the conversation and seeing these people love each other, like these sort of people who were sort of misfits everywhere else, and they were just like a group of kids on a picnic. They were so kind and loving to each other. And I was like, does it really matter? Yeah. Like, she's not advocating giving me sort of psychic surgery, or like suddenly people, she's not saying people shouldn't be immunized. She's just saying, I can speak to horses, and all the horses tell her is be kind to us.
Yeah.
Like, it's fine. If the horses were telling her like assassinate the president, then maybe I would. But
well,
like,
there's loads of, I've heard, again, it's similar. I've heard comedians that I respect, I find incredibly intelligent, who are into this equine therapy. And it is, it's they go once or twice a week to be with their horse. And a lot of it is just touching them and holding them and all this kind of thing. But it works for them. So that's fine, right?
And
in my mind, that's absolutely fine. It's like, it works for you. It's the same. It's the same with my view on religion. Is I was brought up a Catholic. I don't particularly have any beliefs either way now. But I'm fine. If it's used in the right way, I'm fine with it. You go and believe in that. Whether it's a horse or a god, or whatever it is that gets you through, then go right ahead.
Yeah, they in Take a Break, Fate and Fortune, which is a spin-off of Take a Break magazine, but dealing largely with fate and fortune, they do have a monthly column called Texas, the Psychic Horse.
Brilliant.
Where people can write in. And originally, like, it now I'm more comfortable with it because people just write in saying my pet won't, you know, is a bit scared of the attic room. What should I do? And Texas will say, put some dog food up there, and that's fine. Originally, it was people like writing in with their like financial problems. And what's interesting yeah. about it is it's not even claimed that it's Texas answering the questions. He's Texas. The horse has got a spirit guide, so right. it's he's channeling it, and then his owner is psychically speaking to him. So
I mean that makes sense because what would a horse know about finances? I'm glad he's channeling it.
It's but it's the bureaucracy I can't get my head around. Yeah. It's like the Foreign Office or something. You have to go through so many people to get your answer. Yeah. It's a great. The thing is, these things make people happy. And I think like even just, and also I'm sure there are things I believe. In fact, I know because like, I think this is the other thing about having a mental illness, right? Is I believe a lot of stuff that is manifestly not true.
Yeah.
Every month, right? I believe like literally crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And it makes you a lot more sympathetic to someone believing stuff that you don't believe in because you go, but I believed like I believed that like people were watching me across the road. I believed a dude was trying to like climb through my window and it was just a fly that had bumped into it. Like
yeah,
I believe wrong stuff all the time. And that is partly the human condition, right? We're not very good at dealing with ambiguity. We're not very good at dealing with as soon as threat is in the mix, we're not very good at parsing whether that's true or not. So of course, and you know, you just think there, but for the grace of God, right? Or there, but for the grace of a horse. Like you just like go, okay, let's be careful about this because I'm going to be wrong about something, and I hope people can be nice about it when I screw up.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one, and I'm only mentioning this now because it's felt relevant twice in this conversation already. But again, on the kind of the weird shit, I'm not a superstitious person, but for over 10-15 years now, every day I've worn socks with numbers on them that add up to the number 5 because 5 is my lucky number.
Nice.
This is weird. I have them made. Like, it's a specific, it's really odd. And again, I think maybe when I started doing it, I was more superstitious and believed in luck. And now I'm not, but I still do it. And the reason it came to mind earlier as well, because there's that. And also, it's so weird, but all of my pants are the same type of black pants. Both of those things were to take control over something in my life. So I'm not having to have a decision at the start of today of the day to remove the amount of decisions I have to make that aren't important. So rather than, am I going to wear my good blue pants today because I might meet a girl? Or am I going to do this? It's like, remove that. All my pants are the same. I just grab 2 socks that add up to number 5, a 4 and a 1, a 2 and a 3, a 5 and a blank. All fine. And it is something that I think I've put in when maybe I had different reasons for it, but I've kept it in my life because it's taking that control. It's saying, here's a decision early on that I don't have to worry about. The one time I've had what I would feel, and I've not talked about this to anyone actually at all, a few months back or a month or two ago, I had what I think is the first time I've ever had a panic attack. And it's because I was out and I decided everything that was going to happen, and then I got somewhere, one of those Jenga blocks was pulled out and I didn't know what to do. I walked out of the shop I was in, I went to get in my car, I walked back to the shop, I walked in and just kind of mumbled, confused, because I couldn't figure out what to do. And it really spun me out, and it made me realise that that's one of the reasons I take control over these small things that can be in my control, because it is a weakness I have there, is when, because I'm so organised maybe, when confronted with things that just pull that out slightly. And this was literally, I was going to get some food. It wasn't anything important or life-changing, but because I'd got it so clear in my head, I'm going to go there, do this, do that, and because that first one fell through, I ended up, after about 10 minutes, just going home a little bit confused and shook. And I think, again, it made me realise how important these stupid little things, which I joke about. I joke about my socks all the time. I joke about all these things now. But it's having those things. It's like, right, no, that's in my control. And that gives me that comfort at the start of the day to then go, all right, cool. I've got something under control. Now if things go out of control, it's fine.
Because you've made a definite choice.
Yeah.
And I mean, to anyone who's not, you know, suffered from, had some kind of anxiety or, you know, had, a lot of people don't realise that they've had panic attacks as well. They're so often first presenting going to the doctor with something like, they think they're having a heart attack Yeah. Or they think they're literally going insane, because like one of the symptoms of when your sympathetic nervous system starts amping up, when your amygdala starts, you know, you've got like this overactive limbic system in your brain, when it starts, they call it like the amygdala hijack, but like when your amygdala starts taking like resting executive control from the rest of your brain.
Right, wow.
People don't realize that they're having a panic attack. You get often unreality is like a real common symptom, yeah, where you suddenly go, life doesn't feel like it's real. And you feel like you're almost sort of like spaced out and stepped back from it.
100%
suddenly, simple thing suddenly seems weird. You can't work out. You suddenly, it's like being stoned or something. You look and you go, oh, shops are weird, aren't they? You have to like interact, and there's all these, how does this work? Because your brain is like going back several layers into your kind of like reptilian hindbrain, yeah, and none of the modern world makes the slightest bit of sense when parsed in terms of where's the threat, where's the food, where can I shelter? You're like, this is an Apple store. This doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I think those things, and it can be
that's
very scary.
That's all so relatable. As I said, that was all there was just so much just walking back and forth in the little town near me, just kind of not knowing what I'm doing. It was exactly that. It felt like when I've been stoned or when I've been on acid or all these things, yeah, that I did by choice in my youth, to have it all kind of hit you now without choice, it was like, fuck. And then everything was fine. I went home, I watched some films. I'd say for the rest of that day, I was a little bit weird. And my missus, a few times, was like, everything all right? I'm like, yep. Because again, it was just something I hadn't been able to process it yet. I was like, I don't really know what's happening or what has happened. So let's just put the TV on and we'll stare in that direction. Because that was a safety net for me. Like when you give a kid an iPad because it's all got a bit too much. It's like, well, they're going to stare there for a bit. I needed that. I was like, I'm just going to put that on and stare and then it'll all be all right.
Yeah, and I think that's really common, and often it's... I don't mean to like claim there's some kind of like etiology here where, oh, that's how it starts. I was about to say that sounds like too doomy prognosis.
Yeah, look
but
out.
What I mean is like sometimes people have like a small incident and then they start watching for it because they don't know what's happened to them. Yeah. They don't realize it was a panic attack. They don't realize that loads and loads of people have these things and it can't harm you. It's extremely unpleasant, but it can't harm you. And then they start watching for it.
Yeah.
And then if you're watching for something where, A, you don't know what it was, B, you feel shame because, like, how do you explain to someone, I couldn't figure out a shop? People start thinking, did I have a stroke?
Yeah.
Is this the beginning of dementia? Is there something wrong with me? Am I going insane? None of those thoughts lead you to reduced stress and a happy
it's
place.
It's also self-fulfilling, right? Again,
absolutely.
I was kind of lucky, I guess, that as a teenager, I was seeing a young lady who suffered really badly from panic attacks, and I would see how her panic attacks would all be based around the fact that she thought that at some point she was going to have a heart attack, which is then going to raise your heart rate.
Yeah.
And it's all this self-fulfilling thing, and numerous times that we had to get an ambulance, all sorts of stuff, because it was all self-fulfilling. It was that fear was there, so she's looking out for it. So then a slight feeling of my heart rate's rising would then make her heart rate rise. And it's all this weird self-fulfilling thing. So I think because of that, I was lucky. And I was like, right, no, that was just a weird thing that happened. It's over now. But yeah, it's fascinating, as I said, how common these things are, yet how unexplained or undefined they are, I guess, in general. Do you just hear the term panic attack? What does that mean? Were you on the floor? Were you screaming? Were you, it's so vague.
People have like radically different ones from ones where you could be in the room with them and you wouldn't know that they were having a panic attack because they just go quiet. They become shivery. Like it's all like palpitations.
Yeah.
Like it's very internal and they just go quiet and you might not realize. To like me, where most of my panic attacks are like, I still feel sort of like embarrassed about it, but like most of my panic attacks are very external, very like screaming terror, like pinned to the floor, screaming in the way that you would sort of scream if you were in a plane and suddenly they lost cabin pressure and it was like plummeting. That kind of like just like, And it's you know, like, it's difficult. And it is especially, you know, I knew it was hard when my daughter was coming, when I knew I was going to be a dad. I was like, oh, I got to get this sorted out because I don't want to be doing that in front of my daughter. And then, of course, you go into this period where you've got had the least sleep of your life. The stakes are higher than they've ever been before. A little moment of panic, you think, could this be a panic attack? And it's been hard, and I've, you know, and I have had panic attacks, and I've had panic attacks that, where she's sort of been in the house and she's been able to hear some of it. And it's not, you know, it's not what I would choose for myself, and it's not what I would choose for her. And the only but, you know, self-judgment is correlates with more panic attacks. That's just been shown. You can't like beat your way out of it by like making shame like a rod for your back and going, right, you know what the problem is, you don't feel bad enough about yourself. That's why you've been like easing into panic attacks, because you like yourself too much. That will never ever work. And it's kind of like the kind of like Chinese finger trap thing, and it's easy to intellectualize, hard to actually pull off. But this fact that the panic attacks will release their grip a little bit when you start not needing them to go, it's almost like, and I know this is going to sound twee, and I'm not for a moment saying anyone who's having panic attacks should be glad for them, but my anxiety disorder and my panic attacks have changed, have in many ways changed my life for the better. They are more like the symptoms of stuff you are not dealing with, stuff you are not engaging with. I spoke to an author at the weekend, actually, and she said to me, like, whenever you've got writer's block, it is like dealing with writer's block is basically therapy. Like you're not, it's rare that you're blocked because you just can't figure out how the people doing the heist get out the bank. Occasionally you get stuff like that where you're like, I don't know how to hotwire a forklift. I have to go and do that bit of research, and that's why I can't continue, because I've got to know how an engine works. Most of the time, if you are blocked, like dealing with why you're not able to write, it's to do with perfectionism. It's to do with fear. It's to do with, I don't want to finish this book because I need to be always working on it. Anything you do to solve that. And it's the same with panic attacks. Like, I feel like they are just like a very loud alarm that's saying the way you are living and the way you're thinking about your life is not serving you. And it's very unpleasant, but it is, they've steered me towards becoming a better person, I think I'm sort of comfortable with saying.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, let's rewind a little bit and kind of go, because we've known each other for 10 years or so, really, guess. Probably more than that. And we met on the spoken word scene. And do you feel like, having learnt later on in life that you suffered from anxiety and stuff like that, do you feel performing was a coping mechanism for that, or a thing to force yourself to do? Because you were one of the guys I'd regularly book at Bestival, because you were an incredibly safe pair of hands. I knew that not only could you write, you could get up there and nail a performance. You wouldn't have any issues. It always, if there were issues, you were someone who could cope with it. Whereas spoken word, particularly early days, can be a tough one, because it's a lot of people who may have great minds, but not necessarily comfortable in front of crowds, in front of these pressure situations. And you, John Osborne, and a few others, Ross Sutherland, definitely were all guys who I felt safe going, well, these guys will be at the top of the lineup, because I know that if it's a big crowd, or even the more scary thing, if it's a small crowd, they can go out there and handle it. And that's the thing. So how was that as part of you finding you or dealing with you, I guess?
Well, I think that's like sort of really shrewd point you're making, in a way that people don't really understand. If you like go, you can go and perform in front of, like, you know, hundreds or thousands, or like you say, the scariest of all three people, like where you just
far
feel like,
scarier.
Where you feel like you're trapped in a service lift with a family, right? Yeah. Like, but the last panic attack I had a few weeks ago was like the most stupid, childish thing. I mean, again, you hear the self-judgment in it, but like, I had a plate on a table. I was eating my tea while reading something, and I'd put the plate on the edge of the table, and I leant on it, and it like flipped and went in my lap, and I started going, oh, and like got into like a flap and started gasping and panicking and hyperventilating and all these things that are like you'd sort of see in like a like comic character in like a on like TV, like, you know, when they breathe into a paper bag, and all that stuff was true for me. But the fact is, since I can have a panic attack from like a jar of capers falling out the cupboard when I wasn't expecting it to, it's actually not particularly more scary for me to be on stage in front of hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And actually, that's one situation where being adrenalized, having the sympathetic nervous system like activated, having adrenaline pumping through your body that's giving you more energy, that is making you sort of like rise up onto the balls of your feet, that's meaning that you can prowl, you can shout, that you're energized. It is the one socially acceptable situation where I can march up and down like a yelling my thoughts at strangers, and I'm not sort of like, and I don't have someone like come and throw a coat around me and like gently lead me away to have a cup of sugary cup of tea. Like, it's a situation where suddenly being able to cast around for threats is something you do in an audience, not because you're going to like aggressively like call someone a douchebag, but you are casting around. You become hyper aware of, I think this person is bored, so I'm going to project at them to try and make them feel brought back in.
Yeah.
You might look around here and go, oh, look, there's a pillar there that's creating a dead zone behind there. So I'm going to move the audience around towards me so they can see what I'm doing better. You're constantly aware of like, and I have like, I have anxiety dreams about losing a crowd. That's my second most common anxiety dream, is like, it's always my fault as well in the dream as well. Like, I've done a piece that's a bit too self-indulgent or whatever. Yeah. But again, it's like you were talking about with like choosing your socks every morning. So if you are someone like who gets like any kind of anxiety, but like I'm really bad with crowds. Ironically, when I go to festivals, I often can't go into a crowd, or I choose not to, and I get anxious. Not all the time, but sometimes, and particularly actually after I've performed. And the reason I find out the crowds difficult is the same that anyone who has that feeling of what's the opposite of claustrophobia?
Agoraphobia,
right? Agoraphobia for me is like a feeling of like radically diffused irritation that you can't control everyone.
Yeah.
There'll be like a conversation going over there, and maybe there's like some like guys on a train who are a little bit drunk and getting a little bit leery, and you're worried they might. Three more vodkas in might turn, and so you are monitoring them while trying to get on with your life. And so that's one like open browser window over there is the people who might turn later on. And then over here there's sort of like a couple who are arguing, and you feel worried for them. And so that, and I absorb all these different feelings of people going on around me, and it's hard. Now in a audience situation where you're working a room, all of those things are, that's useful data that you can bring into your set, that you can go and you can talk to people. And I'm never kind of like, what do you do for a living, buddy? And then like, I'm not that kind of person, but I definitely try and embrace people in this big sort of sweaty, hairy bear hug. And for me, it's just the one place in my life where having bags of adrenaline, feeling anxious, and spewing my feelings about how I feel was completely normal and accepted.
And not only accepted, applauded,
praised.
That's kind of the beautiful thing. It's fascinating what you were saying, and it makes me think similar with growing up having a stutter. People are like, aren't you scared talking in front of 100 people, 1,000 people? I'm like, I'm scared talking in front of one person. That's my day-to-day life. So
the numbers don't make any difference, right?
So I'm scared all the time. Yes, I was scared going on stage, but no more than scared going into Tesco's. So I go in there all the time.
That's exactly it. Like and it's actually an audience. It's one place where there's a kind of social license to be exerting some kind of control over the people in front of you.
Yeah.
It's not okay on a train to like go, move over to the guys who are like getting drunk and go, actually, can you move closer to me, please? Yeah. You just come a few seats forward. Thanks. Great. Okay. You come, the couple who are having an argument. Lovely to see you. If you can just step forward here right now, would you like a poem about this or about like this? Like that would not probably elicit a good reaction. But with an audience, it's accepted. There's a social contract. I'm going to turn up. I'm going to say some stuff to you. And you're going to look at me. And if you like it, you're going to give me some very clear, unambiguous feedback that you liked it as well. Yeah. So there's not going to be blank faces. Or I'll understand that you didn't like it. But so there's going to be none of this like social ambiguity. Am I boring this person with this conversation?
Yeah.
Because at the end, when I stop, you like literally applaud. That doesn't happen yeah. in a normal anecdote, right? Yeah. Unless it's a
hell of an anecdote. Yeah. I love that. And I couldn't relate more there. There's been points recently as my girlfriend is kind of getting to understand the mess that I am more, that we'll have train journeys and we'll get to the end of it. And she'll now realise that I was quiet for that whole journey because I was bubbling at everyone around me. That conversation was making me furious. That conversation was good, but it was a little bit off. There was a slight bit wrong there. And I'm just going,
you were hearing half a phone conversation.
I need to be home on my own. I don't need to be taking in everything at the moment.
Yeah, you absorb it. Even if it's exciting, even if you're hearing a phone conversation and someone's having like a conversation about like picking up the horse box, and because what that's spiking in you is, and that's a classic thing with like storytellers, right? This is what all good stories do. It's spiking cortisol in you. It's spiking the stress hormone and it's making you pay attention. But paying attention is a hugely metabolically costly thing for us to do. It's why like in basic storytelling structure, you have what's like called Freytag's pyramid. Excuse me if I'm like teaching my grandma how to suck eggs, but like rising action and then falling action. The audience need breaks. And that's not an accident.
Yeah.
It's because human beings respond, you know, in attention-wise best to threat. But we need times to just be able to, we need the scene where the character's like eats some eggs in a diner, right? Because it's knackering.
Yeah.
And if you are someone who is sort of socially conscientious and has that level of awareness, then it can be hard to turn it off. And it's like you are being made to watch five movies, like the rushes to five movies where they haven't really edited it yet, where they don't know what the ending's going to be. The characters don't quite make sense. You're like, who's this person?
Yeah.
Who's it? And you don't even know what genre it is. So you don't know if all these characters are suddenly going to get a wide shot and a bus is going to slam into them.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like when I had my anxiety the worst, actually, I couldn't watch any film where a character walks out into the road and turns back and it's like a wide shot because I was constantly convinced a car was going to hit them.
It's the classic.
And I was like watching Rocky Balboa and it was like 10 minutes in and he does that and he steps back. And I was like ripping the arms of my seat. Yeah. And I'm like, what are the chances that Sylvester Stallone is going to have like Rocky 10 minutes killed in, off by like a random car? Like that would be like a bold directorial choice. But it's not really, it doesn't really feel like a satisfying ending to this boxer's journey. Just be mown down and that's it. But I couldn't, like, to me, every movie was a horror film.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's intense. It's a fascinating one there, because again, it is something that's important, and a lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about is stuff I think that you've learnt as a writer that you can teach to other writers. And that was just straight there, that was a fascinating one. I had a novel that I've it's another reason I was saying I learn more from these than anyone else, but I've had a novel that I've been working on for just over 20 years.
How exciting.
I literally came up with it at college and all this. But a year or two ago, I got to a finish point. I sent it off to a publisher that was interested. And they came back to me. And in my mind, it was shit. It's not going to happen. And I was fine with that. I was at that point, I was like, the important thing here has been completing a draft kind of thing. And then literally a year later, the publisher chased me up. I was like, have you got anywhere with the feedback we gave you? And what I realised was exactly that. The problem I'd had was, because it's a story I've had for so long and I know everyone, from start to finish, it was all the action of the story. And again, I need to preface that with the fact that the point of the story is a very mundane story, so the smallest things feel like action. But what she was highlighting to me was because you know the characters, you know all the mundanity that has lent up to this. We're not having the mundanity. You mentioned early on that I've got a really boring life. And then from then on, it's fascinating. And it's like, no, we need more of the mundane. And I've then done a redraft and it's with the publisher now and we'll probably go back and forth a million times. But it was exactly that. It was things like that of not realising. In my mind, it's like, I need to make sure it's interesting. And it's like, no, readers need breaks and they need ups and downs. And again, it sounds weird because I'm now making out it's some huge action adventure thing. It's a mundane story in general, but it needed more mundanity.
No, and actually what you're talking about, we might as well just like leap straight into it. Yeah. I talked to this neuroscientist called Paul J. Zak. I was really interested, right? I'm really, you know, like when your brain is not working as you want it. And people like often when they've got mental illnesses will say, oh, I got like a broken brain or my like dodgy brain or something. And they're trying to be sort of self-deprecating about it. But it does sometimes unconsciously reinforce the idea that the brain is like you, that we're like born with this mm-hmm. brain. And don't get me wrong. Like some people, you know, do have like neurological issues and challenges that are there. They're congenital. They're there from birth. I'm not saying that, but, the more research that has been done, the more we're seeing like the incredible like neuroplasticity of the brain throughout life. And I was just really interested to know, am I stuck with this? In which case I want to know how I can build like scaffolding to get around my deficiencies. Yep. Or are there ways that I can actually change my brain to be better? Because I so many writers talk about like procrastination, hating doing their draft. Oh my God, like it's like this forced march. They sound like Napoleon marching his troops into like Russia in the Russian campaign, right? It's just like, I've got to get to the end of this draft. And you're like, why is writing, being a novelist, is like, I was like looking online, it is consistently in the top 10, like when they do what's your dream job and they do surveys, it is consistently around the world, like in the top 10 jobs people say they want to do. And yet I've never known any group so bad for like griping and grumbling about how the day-to-day part of it is a kind of hell. And it's like, why does anyone do it? And I was interested in it. And I sort of, being a bit sort of stubborn, I wanted to refuse to accept that is the only way of doing it. I think there's a better way. And what you're talking about in terms of like mundanity and these like gaps in between, once you've got someone's attention, it is no good with the cortisol spike, right? And we're engaged and we're looking. You don't then want them just to feel, it would be a horrible story if you're then just like zapping them like with the kind of cattle prod of kind of like danger the whole way through. Why would anyone keep reading? Even thrillers, even like nail-biting thrillers, don't do that. And the kind of other part of the mix, which this neuroscientist Paul J. Zak was talking to me about, and he does this, you know, taking blood samples from people, putting them in like liquid nitrogen, taking them back to his lab. He's like taken blood samples from people before and after saying their wedding vows at a wedding. Like he went down in Kent and like took blood samples from the bride, like 10 minutes before she went out in this like big house. He had like, he had all this like lab equipment, like dry ice, kind of like crazy stuff, right?
Yeah.
To look at this thing called oxytocin, which is like the trust hormone, right? It's like released when I know about it because when my wife gave birth, the first thing they do is do, if they can, is do skin to skin where they put the child on the mum's chest, and that releases oxytocin, and it's what brings the milk down, and it's what helps. It helps with thermoregulation. It helps with bonding. And we've got this thing, but it's also something we release as human beings when we, any kind of ritual that bonds us, any kind of thing that we do, from like doing a haka to like singing happy birthday to wedding vows, releases oxytocin. Oxytocin is released if you take MDMA as well.
Yeah.
It makes you feel a greater sense of community. It makes you more likely to trust people. And when they've shown people 2-minute films that release cortisol and then release oxytocin, so I'll give you an example of like, when me and my wife were trying for a baby, her dad fell. He was terminally ill. He was in hospital with cancer, and we knew he didn't have long. And it was like he had his 40th wedding anniversary, and we went in and we had to have it in hospital, and then we told him that we had a baby on the way, and it was a little bit early. It was like week 11, but we told him, and then that night. Or the night after, we went home, and my wife in the night said, "I'm started bleeding. We need to go to the hospital." And we didn't go until the next morning. And we had to go to the same hospital he was in, and we went to the unit next to it. And they take you into this room, and they said, "We'll move your scan forward." And they got the jelly, the and for the ultrasound, and they moved it across her belly, and the screen comes up, this kind of blue sort of windscreen kind of wedge shape, and I know what that looks like when there's a baby there, and there was nothing, and they said, "We can't see it, there's no," and I remember literally, it sounds so weird, but I remember pouring at the air, clawing at the air, before the screen, and going, "Where's it gone? Where's it gone? Please get it back. Help." Because I was just, and that was, and then we had to go and tell, her dad. Now that story I just told is true, but I'm doing it deliberately to be manipulative, because what that will have released in people is at the beginning a stress response of me telling you something bad's going to happen, there's some bleeding, you probably raised your cortisol levels, and then I started talking about a miscarriage and people being sad, and that releases oxytocin, and that releases this feeling of bonding amongst people. And they showed in this 2-minute film where they told a real story about a dad talking about his terminally ill 2-year-old, and him wondering whether he could spend the time. And it's online if you want to watch the film. Yeah. It's really hard to watch how much he wanted to get close to his son. His son was like a normal boy playing, but he found it hard to get close to him because he knew the boy was going to die. Yeah, yeah. People having watched that film are 80% more likely to give money to charity. Doesn't have to be anything to do with terminally ill children. The effect runs afterwards for over 48 hours of that release of oxytocin. People will give more money to charity. They'll be more generous. They'll be more likely to trust people. All of that is something deeply human. And so what you would, and to get back to what you're saying about the mundane moments in between the kind of action, the cortisol spikes, that's what's happening in those mundane moments. That's what's happening in a Pixar movie where before the robots stage a breakout, we see them getting bits of junk around them and playing tennis together. Yeah. And one of them's a bit clumsy and kind of keeps bumping its head. And that is spiking oxytocin in us. Mm. So when we get the next big cortisol spike, we are invested, because this is the thing that makes human beings in a small group, in a small community, look after each other's children, protect them from outsiders. I'd say oxytocin, also, it's talked about less, but also makes you more wary of perceived outsiders, people you don't. It can make people you perceive them more as threat. And that is all about this kind of ancient response we've got in us about we perceive suffering amongst each other. And it's kind of quite beautiful that it makes the brain release oxytocin, and we are more likely to look after each other and be kind. And if we hear it, and the brain is functionally, and this is what's so interesting about this new sort of field of neuroscience and examining it in terms of narrative and stories, is the brain, when with our current functional magnetic resonance imaging scans, we are unable to distinguish between a brain that is remembering an event and a brain that is watching a movie that it's engaged with. There is no, we are currently, it's currently indistinguishable between us, a fictional thing, and a real thing
that happened to us. That's absolutely fascinating.
So storytellers have a huge power over people.
Yeah. That's fascinating. We touched upon a procrastination there. And again, it's a massive thing for writers. Again, it's the main thing that the writers will complain about how hard it is and all this. And I often have, I've not really got any good clues or tips, but the thing I always think is, I often have people surprised at my work rate, at how I have so many different projects and get so many things done. And the truth to that is, number one, again, as we kind of touched on, I need to have something to be working on. I'm happier in that situation. Otherwise, my mind can go to all the horrible places it might want to. I like having projects. But my best way of completing a project is to have a project I want to work on less. So I can then go, I need to finish this first. I can't do that. So it's why, again, it's why the novel has been 20 years, because I've had albums to write, films to write, all sorts of other things to go, I'll work on this and then I'll get back to that at some point. So that's been a key for me, I guess, is having, if I'm procrastinating and not working, at least I'm being productive on something else. And I've spoken to Polar Bear about this a lot as well, how never... is he more keen to write raps than after he's finished a novel? Because he's had to do that and he's not been allowed to do the one. But then as soon as he's worked on an album, he's gagging to get back to writing a novel or verse or whatever else. And yeah, it's interesting kind of balances and worlds there.
Yes, it is. And that can, if you can like make that work, It can be really useful. It's just that for a lot of people, what ends up being the thing they wouldn't like to do is the novel, and the thing that they feel more comfortable doing is like the busy work, like sending emails, like doing the day-to-day like job, like firefighting. And I think I want to make it clear, although I was taking the mickey out of writers for complaining, I know from personal experience, you know, my first book that I wrote, The Honours, that came out in 2015, like actually wasn't that hard to write. Like I had felt like I'd kind of given up on writing novels, right? I was like, I'm a performance poet now. So kind of like you said, like I didn't feel like anyone was looking at me going, you're a writer.
Yep.
I felt like I could be crap.
Yeah.
And like in the same way as if I just like went surfing, I don't think anyone would be watching going, oh, think you're a surfer, do you? You're pretty amazing. I think anyone would like look at me like the way I carried a board, like walking out towards the sea and going, this is going to be a disaster. And they'd be just happy for me for having a try, right? The same with writing. I didn't identify as being a writer or an author. So it didn't feel pressured to me. And I just had the space to be crap for a long time, actually. Yeah. Let the story build up and be doing it for me. Second novel didn't feel like that at all. It felt like, oh God, like people have, you know, the weirdest thing was actually I started writing the second novel when I was up in Edinburgh doing a show. I would do it, like you said, like it would be something I was doing for me, like a treat when I wasn't performing. Yeah. And I was flying through it. I was like writing 14,000 words a week.
Edinburgh is where I got the bulk of my novel written. After years of not getting anything, the one year I did The Fringe, the daytimes just is, it was exactly that. It's like, here's my treat, I'm gonna write. And that was,
I get to be left alone,
yeah,
and I get to do this
and
thing.
I don't have to worry about which show I should be seeing, who I should be socializing with. It's like, no, I've got this to do, this is my escape.
Exactly. So and then the first reviews of The Honours came out, and like I don't want to be a knob about it and like be going, and they were rather good. But like the first time, because some people hated it, right? But like the first time I read a couple of reviews with people going, I love this, this is exactly what I wanted. Like this is, you know, and I love this and I really enjoyed this and I've not read anything like it before. I was like, oh my God, you look at what you're writing, like the crappy first draft, and you go, they're going to hate this. It's not the same. Because I haven't just produced the same thing over and over again. I've tried to like push myself.
Yeah.
The difficult second album, right, is like the classic thing, right? Were you thinking, oh, if people liked, because that's what I had, like, is just going, if you like this, I was then now imagining there's this group of people I could disappoint. Wasn't worried about, I imagined that what was going to happen is that I was going to write a first novel, and if people liked it, I would be able to relax and go, oh, I'm a proper novelist now. I'm allowed to continue producing. And actually what happened was, for the first time, I had people that I might disappoint. Amanda Palmer talks about like being tapped on the head by the like magic wand of legitimacy, and I always really liked that. I genuinely thought that was going to happen.
Yeah, I had, again, I was lucky that I had my brain worked for me in that at that time in that situation. And it's a weird one because I don't know if that was replaying now, I would have reacted differently. But my mind at that point was because me and Dan Lesac had made an album completely our own way, despite being pushed to go in a pop direction or this or that, we'd made it our own way and it had been a success. So we had the outlook of, well, we can just make it. Like, we don't have the pressure of pleasing anyone. Now, the fact is, our second album is our least well-received. It still suffered. And I built up a theory that the second album syndrome is more a syndrome of the fans and the listeners, because you've had this one little soundbite of these people and then you've built a whole character around them. And then you hear their next record, which is true to them, but you're like, well, that's not who I thought they were.
Yeah.
And again, if I'd been aware of that, I might have panicked more on the second album and changed it. But thankfully, because I wasn't, it's like, right, no, I'll just keep doing it. But I think that wouldn't have
been helpful to you, right? It wouldn't have helped the process.
You'd be thinking, how do I please them?
Yeah.
Like, you can't.
Yeah.
You literally can't.
It's true. And I think I really, really struggled with that because the first time I felt like there's people I'm going to let down. And I started...
It seems
not being able to write.
So odd to have the complaints or pressure of success, but it's real because all of us will always. Everyone I've spoken to on here, Armando Iannucci jumps to mind because he's someone that I feel has rarely put a foot wrong. He spoke frequently of imposter syndrome. So all of us have imposter. So when you're doing your first novel, you're still like, I mean, I'm not really one of these. This is a fluke. And then when it is received well, which is what you've aimed for, there is then that horrible pressure of, all right, we'll prove yourself.
Well, because that's when the...
Who are you? You're one of us, are you?
That's when the imposter syndrome starts, right? Because, like, before that, like, I've always had a slight little bit of kind of, like, rubbing my hands like a little gremlin and going, hee-hee-hee-hee. Like, I'm going to bluff my way into the party.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm going to go up and like look down that list. I'm going to get in and I know I don't fit here, but it's like a lark.
It's going to be nice to surprise them.
Yeah. And then I'll come out later and I'll tell my mates that time I got into a place that I wasn't really supposed to, but I'll kind of come back down. And then when people start turning around and going, you're a writer, and you go, It's like a mask that eats into the face, right? Like, you're like, I don't think I can stop this character now that I'm the Tim the writer. Like, it's in it. I found, and it sounds silly, but I think also, like, when you suffer from, like, anxiety as well, and also, like, it being potentially, like, it's your career and it's, like, what's going to allow you to pay your mortgage, and suddenly you're going, I don't think this is very good. I'm not sure what I'm doing. And the authors I speak to, it, like, As sort of silly and a luxury problem it is, it makes people genuinely miserable. And those are the people we hear from. There's a load of other people who would love to write, who would love to sit down. And then the moment they do, they get that voice saying, What are you doing? And they get very adept at just not engaging with that, not even starting, not even giving themselves the pleasure. And there's so many good things, like, documentably brilliant things that can happen to your, like, well-being and your mind and all sorts of stuff when you write, regardless of if another soul ever likes what you've written.
You know what was one of the biggest motivations for me on that front was Moose Rockwonga, who's, again, I need to clarify, every time I mention him, people think I'm saying Moose Rockwonga, but it's Musa, M-U-S-A, Okwonga, who we've both gigged with for years.
Yeah.
He's an amazing writer. And was out having a drink with him and Polar Bear once, and him revealing that he'd written, I think, four or five novels before what is perceived as his first novel, and three of them not a soul in the world has ever read, two of them a few people read, but it didn't click, so it didn't get published. And that was just both, as a writer of poetry and rap and stuff like that, then everything I wrote, I'd go and do on stage. I'd be excited about, I've written a new thing, here it is. If it works, it works. If not, it's not. The idea of putting so much into writing 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100,000 words to never let anyone see was hugely motivational, because his outlook was, no, but I got better at it with each of them. I learned It wasn't necessarily about what anyone else gets from that story. It's what I learned. An example also comes to mind. My brother, it still plays on my dad's mind more than my mum's, I think, that he got a 2-1 at university. He was doing philosophy and he lived in a cottage in Wales, and he finished his final essay and it had been snowing, and it was the day of handing it in, and he didn't go and hand it in. They've since said if he had, he would have got a first, and they've used that specific essay as examples. But his thought, again, a philosophy student, was, I'm not learning anything more by driving through the snow to hand this in. All I'm getting is a different bit of number on a bit of paper. The bit of paper isn't why I came here. I came here to learn what I've learned. And that's always been hugely inspirational to me. Still, my parents...
That is awesome. That's like his drinking hemlock, right? Yeah. He's like going, look, if you want to, like, here's like a definite like clash of two principles.
Yeah.
Which one do I value more? It's a great demonstration of what he values.
It's amazing.
Right?
Still to that day, even understand it, my parents still go, yeah, but you should have just handed it. It's like, you're missing the point here, particularly with a philosophy degree of all the degrees, for fuck's sake.
Say,
but
yeah.
There's still that kind of, yeah, but if you just, it would have been a first though, wouldn't it? It's like, all I would have earned, the difference between a 2-1 and a first was a drive. That shouldn't be the difference between a 2-1 and a first. But yeah, it's a fascinating one there. That was motivational to me to know that you can write and it can still give you everything you want, even if no one else ever reads it. I mean, it's great if you write and then release it. So the benefits, you were saying before I started rambling, that there is huge benefits for your psyche, your character, from just creative writing itself, regardless of releasing or becoming a writer.
In fact, I would say, like, there's a bunch of stuff that you probably would choose not to, you know, you might just choose not to share. Like, I think writing for, I'm like a big advocate of like writing 10 minutes most days of the week, but like you set a timer for 10 minutes, like literally like get your phone timer, set it for 10 minutes, get your like book, and you just free write. You like write about whatever you want. If you need like a prompt, you can like get a page of like a lyric or something like that, or get something out of a book, or just pick a word. If you just want to write what's in your head, going like blah blah blah, can't think of anything. A man walks down the road, he finds a dog, the dog's name is Terry. Terry says, you know, like you just brain spew, right?
Yeah,
that is training your brain every day to, it starts to help you get through that inner critic. It starts to train your brain that it's okay to produce ideas, regardless of what's going to come out of them. Now, there are palpable, like, we can talk about like actual like benefits that you can sort of see and measure. I spoke to this psychologist called James W. Pennebaker, who I'd learned about, who like was mainly in the University of Texas. I'd learned about, like, 20 years ago, I first heard of his work. He was a social psychologist who was really interested he became interested in expressive writing. And he got, almost by accident, actually, they just like added this question to a big health questionnaire that they were doing. And one of his students said, why don't you just add a question saying, what's like the most traumatic experience you've ever had in your life? Like, to a question, the thing that was just like, how many doctor's visits you had? And they just idly like added it to this huge data thing. And he found, and I love how people sort of stumble across this stuff, that was the biggest predictor of, like, if they'd had a traumatic experience in their first sort of 9 years of life, biggest predictor of like hospital visit frequencies as adults, biggest predictor of illnesses. And you found that like when people were holding on to experiences, stressful, traumatic experiences, that it made them sick. It made them unhappy. Now, some of that is like blindingly obvious, right?
Yeah.
But what he then found is that they got people to come in, students. They did it mainly with university students at first in the University of Texas. And over four consecutive days, write for a quarter of an hour with the brief, write about the most traumatic or upsetting experience of your life. Write continuously for the full 15 minutes. Try to reflect on your emotions then and now. Use details. Each day they could either write about a different experience, or they could write about the same one from multiple angles. 4 days, right? they found off the basis of that study, and it's been replicated. There's been over 200 follow-up studies. It's been replicated again and again. I've read like the abstracts of studies they're doing now. So this is over 20 years. People who did it for the next 6 months, their visits to the doctor dropped by 50%. Wow. They've done studies where they've taken blood tests later on and found that people's immune system, their like white blood cell count, their antibodies rise in the 1 week later and stay risen for the next 6 months after doing just like that hour over 4 days of writing about something upsetting and relating feelings then and now and going into detail about like senses like touch, taste, things like that. They found that this is the crazy one, right? I don't know whose idea it was to start doing this, but they took like punch biopsies of students. So that is when you get like a, it's like a hole punch on the skin,
right,
that you normally would use to take a skin sample. So it's like about a millimeter hole that you punch in the flesh. And they found that people who did the exercise like heal that wound quicker.
Wow.
Having written about something traumatic and got it off their chest, right? To the extent now that the current studies are more, okay, if someone needs to go in for surgery, because it briefly, what it does though is for the few days afterwards, it briefly suppresses the immune system. It briefly takes longer to heal. They're now looking, if someone needs to go in, say, for heart surgery, when after the heart surgery is the best time, or before is the best time for them to start doing an expressive writing exercise to heal their stitches quicker after they've had surgery. Like, this is not like, I know my immediate response when I started reading about this was like, this is hit some hippie bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is one of those things that is going to be like in a journal that has got no credibility whatsoever. Yeah. But this is like, there's been meta critiques written on it. It's all peer reviewed studies. You can go and read the abstracts.
I mean, it's fascinating because we're coming back round to Wim Hof again. And one of the things I used in the episode with him is to kind of get people on board and say, look, I know some of this is going to sound like heavy bullshit, but because a lot of his thing is about he's taking control of his immune system and it's through breathing things and all this and a mental thing. And the easiest way I could explain it was we've all had a time in our life where we're really busy and we're too busy to get ill. And then as soon as we have a weekend off, we get ill. That's your mind taking control of your immune system automatically and not consciously. Wim Hof's thing was consciously. The study example you're using here is using expressive writing to take that some kind of control over it. But it's so untapped and ununderstood how much control we have over our bodies, over healing, over immune systems, over all that kind of thing. So it's always a fascinating one. I found that to be the best example I could come up with to go, I know you're listening thinking this is nonsense, but has this ever happened to you? It has. Therefore, the mind can take some kind of control over these things.
Well, here's the crazy thing about it. Here's the bit that, like, so I spoke to James W. Pennebaker and he said, oh, it's all like you're suppressing the memory of this stressful thing. And his theory is like the effort of holding in unhappy memories.
Yeah.
And to be clear, right, it's not, like, rumination is a different thing. When someone's depressed, they might repeat the same experience over and over. Anyone like listening who maybe struggles with like PTSD or something like that, they'll go, look, I'm not holding that in. I like relive that.
Yeah.
Like I without wanting to, right?
Yeah.
To be clear, it is not just, you know, he told me that like people like would, after he got this research, he was like the guy who people would approach at parties and tell like their sad story or their difficulty. And those people had like crappy health. Like, it's not about just repeating the same story over and over. It's making the effort to make sense of something and construct it. Even if the story and the meaning that you apply to it is completely different to one you had before, it's the effort after meaning. Now, what I find interesting is that his theory holds water, but like, just to be clear, in case people were thinking that I'm saying there's no controversy over this at all, some people had the bright idea of doing a follow-up study where they went, what if we just got people to write about traumas that had never happened? What if we just get them to write fiction? Same effect.
Wow.
So now we're like, now we're in a situation where we're like, well, what's that about? Because they weren't, They weren't holding that in.
Yeah.
That never happened.
Yeah.
And yet you still get the elevated immune response. You still get the fewer doctor visits. You still get the improved healing, even if someone... So now we're back to like talking about horror movies. Now yeah. we're talking about that thing about raised cortisol levels, people then going into releasing oxytocin. We're now going like, maybe there is something inherently bonding and inherently... you know, I don't want to use the word because it's not, you know, totally scientific, but healing about human beings going through stories. Now, I've got a pet theory about this, completely unlike tested, but like, yeah. I wonder whether when we write stories where people go through a journey, when people, you know, whatever, and when we have something that releases cortisol and then oxytocin, when we see someone go through that journey of struggle, conflict, and then resolution, when we bond with them, maybe what we're doing is a little bit like, manual dreaming, right?
Yeah.
Like we have stressful dreams all the time. It's been shown, like the studies show, like when someone's depressed or when someone suffers from anxieties, their dreams become the content of them. They dream more and the content of their dream becomes more distressing.
Yeah.
And actually people, one of the problems with people with like severe depression is that you have so much REM sleep. You have so many dreams that actually you miss out on your deep sleep and you get knackered because you're mind is so trying to yeah. like process the trauma that you actually can't get a decent night's sleep
yeah, and they can't actually be rested. And again, it's a simple thing there of anyone who hasn't had trouble in dreams or just in general the kind of control and power of dreams is that if you have something scary happen in the dream, your heart rate rises.
Yeah.
If you have something sexy happen in the dream, something yeah. else may yeah. rise. But, you know, these things are real physical reactions. So there is a distinction between types of sleep and types of dreaming because you could be exhausting much of yourself while you're asleep and while you're going through these things.
Absolutely.
It's the same, yeah, it's releasing those same things.
And I just wonder whether sometimes this form of storytelling, this is just a hypothesis that I'm really interested to test. It's one yeah. of the things I'd really like to start speaking to people and ask about, is whether when we tell stories, we are just kind of like taking it out of automatic into manual and we are exploring traumas and we are doing some of that dreaming in a kind of like conscious manual way. Like, well, actually, when I say it out loud, it doesn't sound that controversial, but yeah. but I just want to distinguish something that's just my speculation
yeah,
from
yeah,
stuff
yeah,
where I can like show you the papers.
It's fascinating
show you the responses.
As well, because the fact is with fiction, what you have to take into account is that all of us, no matter how much our fashion or social media habits might suggest otherwise, all of us are unique individuals and everything that's happened to us in our life has led to that point. And I don't want to get all too deep about stars and particles and everything else, all these crazy things.
No, you shouldn't be ashamed of that, right? Like, why have we got this enculturated thing where we're not allowed to talk about human life being miraculous?
Yeah, but again,
it is.
Complete miraculousness that has led all of this and your parents and all this other thing. So even if you're writing fiction, the traumatic things that have happened in your life are going to influence the subjects that you pick. Even if they yeah. don't seem related, the subjects, the topics, the challenges of that character, they're going to come from, even if you don't feel that you're purging in any way, they're going to come from somewhere. So they're going to be related to that. So it makes perfect sense in reality that writing fiction can have the same effect as confronting a troubling thing that's happened in your life. Because it's your fiction. It's not anyone else's fiction. It's your fiction.
Exactly. And you don't have to consciously decide, I'm going to take this thing on. Like, I speak to over and over again with other authors, and it happened with me, with all my stuff. Like, I have this weird thing, and you might have had it with your work as well. I don't know. It might just be me. But often I'll write about something, think I'm writing about fiction or I'm inventing a character, and it's only like 6 months, a year, 4 years later, I go, oh, that's me.
Yeah.
Like, or it predicts something that's going to happen. You know, I write my first poetry collection, my second book is called Pub Stuntman. And there's like a poem in it about a guy who like just like drinks and kind of like does all this stupid crap while he's drunk. And the last line was like something like, a human hid inside this prat. I smothered him with clowning. I was much too far out all my life and not waving, but downing. And I, in my head, and like not being in any way disingenuous, I would tell people, oh, it's just about like, it's about someone I used to know back at home who was like in the pub. I wasn't joking. I thought so. And then a year after writing it, I was like, I've got a drink problem. I need to stop drinking. And I stopped and I've been teetotal for 5.5 years now. And I suddenly went, and nobody who saw that poem thought it was about anyone but me. Wow. Nobody, like in retrospect, nobody watching it. Everyone was like, oh, we thought it was autobiographical.
Yeah.
No, and
that's
like
fascinating. I wonder if there was anything at the time of writing though, because there's something that I've found is I think I benefit a lot from being forgetful. I think it's the reason I don't think about having a stutter when taking on roles or things like that. It's like I forget about that, and I've had that with songs where I would have been performing it for 2 years, and someone will say about this and how deep it is, and I'll be like, oh, yeah, that was about a really big part. It's now just noises, or it's now just I'm about the performance and this and that. But I'll just forget that it probably, for that hour I was writing it, it was really hard to be that open and honest. As soon as it was finished, I was like, oh, that's really good. Yeah. I'm really excited for people to hear this. And it allows you to detach yourself,
and
I guess.
And you reprocess it, and it becomes a different part of your mind, and it becomes something that you kind of get some kind of emotional closure on. And that isn't, you know, and I think you know, almost certainly, and we can talk about this, but like you almost certainly reprocess it in a different part of your brain, and you are literally relating to it and retrieving it from a different part. So it's like it's gone from the kind of like, well, what the limbic system, you know, I've got like an overactive amygdala, I've got this kind of like overactive limbic system, that's what responds to threat, that's the fight, flight or freeze response, versus the parasympathetic nervous system, which is activated, that's the kind of like a rest and digest part of the nervous system, right?
Yeah.
When we ruminate and we're in the kind of brain's default mode, we are unable to distinguish between threats that are part of our memory, that are embarrassments. Like, I'm the guy who like walks along the road, remembers something he said when he's seven, and starts like gurning and like folding myself into a clam with like embarrassment. And but the response my body is having is fight or flight, right? It's like I'm trying to hide. I'm trying to hide from a predator. Like that's what that embarrassment response is. It's just the fact that our like latest level of evolution has made us fear more than predators, ostracization, right? We're afraid of doing something that gets us kicked out of the community, because then you starve, right? It's the same reason why people talk about like alpha males and all this kind of nonsense that is like evolutionary bollocks, because actually the latest phase of human evolution hardwired us not to follow people who are physically strong, but it like leaders and people that we are hardwired to be attracted towards and want to follow are people who are intelligent, because they're the people who can find a fresh water supply. Yeah. They're the people who can parse what berries to eat. And the biggest correlation between intelligence and the biggest external sign of intelligence that we had when we made that final evolutionary leap was oral fluency. So it's people who are able to like, and like, I realize that might sound quite self-serving, right? Yeah. I'm like, going, oh, it turns out like that the most natural leaders
most
are like
important people.
People who can like chat bollocks for ages. But it's true that we have an underlying wiredness towards that. And I do think it's true that we are unable to, I mean, like, people talk nonsense, of course, about the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. I hear it all the time. I've sat through so many lectures on stress and anxiety because I've gone through every different type of therapy. None of it particularly helped me, but like, I do laugh when I see someone like reading out from a sheet and they go, well, the fight or flight response is there to, what would happen is it used to be useful. So, you could outrun a lion. And I'm like, lions have got a land speed of 40 miles an hour. Like, if my anxiety disorder, Usain Bolt, I think like his top speed was like 18 miles an hour. If I could write at like what would have to be like 42 miles an hour, you know what? I'd be like firing starting pistols by my head every day to keep that mother going.
Constantly. That'd be amazing. I do have to also add that you need to be aware of the world you live in or circles you mix in when you're saying people talk shit all the time about the whatever that bit before nervous system was. Yeah. I was like, do they too? Is yeah, people, I mean, people always talk so much
about this. But I think like when you've got an anxiety disorder, like you do like get loads of people, you're reading books all the time going, yeah. How? So yeah, like in my world, everyone is constantly, yeah, fair enough.
I was like, oh, they're so hard to them, they're so hard. I have to start to wrap things up now, as we're at 75 minutes, which seems insane because it honestly feels like I've been talking for 10 minutes. I normally, after I've stopped, I'll say to a guest every now and then, oh, that flew by. But this is, I'm hoping the listener has had it as easy as us, because this feels like we've been chatting for 5-10 minutes. But I want to kind of wrap things up, or get towards wrapping things up, by kind of saying if you can offer some advice to people who do have, feel they have a novel in them, a story in them, a film, a computer game, any of these different things in them, how they can go about action in that. Because my advice has always been largely down to a complete lack of understanding of how everything works in my head. My only advice has always been, just do it. Because that's been the simple thing I feel that has differentiated me from friends of mine that have wanted to do similar things to me. Not to say that I'm above any of the people I'm friends with or grew up with, but for those who wanted to do stuff that I've done and didn't, I feel there's some who are far better talkers than me, are far better, so much more going on. I just happen to be the one that went, no, I'm just going to actually do it. But I feel that's an oversimplification because of my own lack of understanding of what's actually behind it all. So what can you kind of tell people as a guide or as a force?
Yeah, great. I can give some concrete stuff. I always want to like undersell and over deliver, but I can tell you some stuff that's worked for me,
yeah.
Based on the best latest data that we've got. And like, I don't want to, you know, I know I keep talking about neuroscience and stuff like that. It's just because I've gone on this kind of quest in the last sort of 4 months to really like find the latest data, because a lot of writers, we share things ourselves, we go, what works for you? And nobody really knows. And I thought,
yeah,
there are people who've been like studying this for like 20 years.
Yeah.
Would it be worth crossing the floor and asking them if they've got any tips? And it turns out they have. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, we cracked this actually.
I love it.
And I just want to say, like, I spent 4 years working on my novel, The Ice House, which is out fairly soon. I spent 4 years working on it, and it was really hard and it was brutal. I wrote 250,000 words, wow. Cut it down to 135,000. Wow. I put myself through hell writing that book, and I didn't need to. And it was all because of stuff I was doing in my brain, and I refused. And people do not need to go through that. You're right that it's just do it, but there's reasons why people don't. And I don't, if anyone's out there and you've ever struggled, I'm going to say this is how to do it. Because as soon as I started applying these things, I spoke to a guy called Dr. Tim Pitchell, who people always laugh when I say, but he works at the Procrastination Research Group, and they're like, oh, does he? And it's like, no, he's actually an internationally renowned expert on it. And don't take the mickey. Like, but yeah, it's always funny. But he spent 20 years studying this, collating data. They've done fMRI scans on the brains of procrastinators versus non-procrastinators. They look fundamentally different, right?
Wow.
So if you procrastinate, your brain is wired differently. This is not, you know, it's, and I want to say that as it's kind of like, it's under your control, but it's not your fault. So first off, right, procrastination, a lot of people feel like I can't help it. Mm-hmm. Procrastination, they call it volitional dysfunction, but that is a voluntary delay in any action that you, and knowing that when you voluntarily delay that action, you're going to end up worse off.
Right.
So it's not the same as like if I had to go into like hospital, yeah, and I wasn't writing my novel, no one would be saying, oh, Tim's been procrastinating.
Yeah.
They'd be of course, that was sensible. That's a reasonable thing. It's something that you do. No, it's that. And that's what makes it so painful, because you know you're being your own worst enemy. So here's the first thing. I want to just explain like how people can understand what's going on. It's people think that it's like laziness. They think it's they're not being disciplined enough. Mm-hmm. They'll say that like, oh, well, you've got to be more disciplined. It is nothing to do. All the data suggests it's nothing to do with under-regulation of behavior. It's misregulation. What people do is, I'll explain what that is. When you want to do something, you have a thought like, I'm going to write that book,
yeah,
and you go to sit down to do it. you feel stress. That's the amygdala kicking in. That's the limbic system. They kick in and you start thinking to yourself, you remember times you've been embarrassed before. You remember times, you remember the teacher at school who told you you were shit. You remember the bullies that surrounded you and said, what are you reading, Tim? Oh, yeah. You, all those people appear. You remember the critics, and your brain is unable to distinguish between threats that are imagined or past threats and physical threats that are there in front of you. So you get a stress response. You, the sympathetic nervous system kicks in. You get elevated adrenaline. You get elevated cortisol. Your brain is, your, all the creative parts of your brain, in fact, start shutting down because you don't need to be able to do a good painting when you're under threat. You need to be able to like get up a tree, right? So immediately it becomes harder to write.
Right.
And so then suddenly it's harder to write. And what you attempt then is what they call a mood repair. So basically, in that situation, you go, I'm going to distract myself. I'm going to, you know, like what you were saying earlier when you were feeling stressed, you looked at the TV, you pick up your phone, you get on an app, you go on social media, you do whatever. And temporarily, that distraction, you're now no longer thinking about the critics hating you. You're now no longer thinking about how things are going wrong, and your mood temporarily improves by you, you're feeling less. Mm-hmm. However, in the long term, you're going to make yourself feel worse because you've not started it. So this is the first thing for people to understand, is that it is a problem of misregulation, not underregulation. And being harsher to yourself and trying to sort that out, you are actually doing an amazing job of helping yourself feel all right. The moment you feel that stress, you're stepping in going, don't worry, I got this. We're going to look at Twitter. Don't worry. And that is a wicked feedback loop that gets hard. Every time you do that, every time you pick up the phone, every time you watch TV, every time you go and start like rearranging the kind of like novelty thimbles on your mantelpiece, that is like putting a wrap of like a kind of sheath around those different like cortical pathways. It's thickening them and it's reinforcing that circuit in your brain. So you have to think about it less and less and less until eventually you can just... You don't, like, if you're anything like me, social media just, there's a muscle memory that makes it appear. Yeah. There's a muscle memory that makes the card app on your phone appear. There's a muscle memory and you don't, and you look around and you realize you've done it. So that is what you're fighting, and it takes a while to turn that ship around. Yeah. The good news is, it's just like, you know what? Like, going into cold showers is one of the things that helped me with procrastination, because it allowed me to start thinking about, like, here's something that is going to... I know one thing I'd encourage people to look at is, when you finish writing, do I feel better, same, or worse? When I get into that cold shower afterwards, do I feel better, same, or worse? The answer was always, I've never felt worse for having a cold shower. Yeah. I have never felt worse for starting the timer for 10 minutes. Starting the timer, listen, if you can't get started with your writing, one of the things is that I was told that made a difference to me, that I went from writing nothing for 4 months to writing 50,000 words in two, is and loving it. I am writing a book at the moment. I am loving it. I am, it's joy. Yeah. It is manna. Every day I get up, I'm like, I've got a chance. I sneak it in the way people sneak in eating crisps or having a wank. I'm like, oh my God, I've got like this book to do. But for ages, I never felt less like a writer than when I was writing. Yeah. When I had the fantasy about writing, great. But as the moment I sat down, I felt inadequate and not up to the task. And that doesn't mean that you're not a writer. It doesn't mean that you haven't got a right to tell your story. Set a timer for, but saying, set a timer for 3 minutes and say that you're going to write two sentences in that 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Set it on your phone. It sounds too simple, or it sounds stupid. Set yourself the most lowball target and write 2 minutes. Do a list. Like, I'd say before you even people start to write a book, like saying I'm going to sit down and write a novel is a fundamentally unexecutable command. Yeah. It's like literally no human has ever sat down and written a novel. Mm. What you do is you can... think, here's four words that changed my life. What's my next action? I mean, there's, you know, with a contraction there for what's, what is, what's my, four and a half, what's my next action? And for me,
can
it's
we
often...
make it five because of my obsession with the number five?
Yeah,
so
okay.
I'll go for what is my
what
next
is my next action? So this is what Dr. Tim Pitcher told me, and it's changed my life. So, like, for me, often it's like, have you opened your laptop and switched it on? Now, that is not... I'm going to write a novel.
Yeah.
That is like, I can open it. It's not stressful for me to open a laptop. Yeah. Like, cool. Have you switched on Word or whatever, or Noveler or whatever you're using or to write? Okay, so you open that file. Okay, cool. Have you started your timer for 3 minutes? No, I can open my phone and set up a timer. I can do that. That's nice. Have you pressed start? What's my next action? Press start. Now you're into it. And now you've got to write two sentences. I'm telling you, you start changing your brain. You start changing that threat response, that enlarged amygdala, and then you start having fun. What I'd suggest is a really great way of like getting into writing. Don't start writing a novel. Spend the one I start off with all the time, and writing groups go, oh, this seems too easy. And because I've made this like 8-week writing course that's available for free online, people can just go on and it's like 10 minutes every day for 8 weeks, right? It's the most successful thing I've ever done, including all my books.
Yeah.
And I just did it because like something was delayed. Like my book was submitted. The email I accidentally didn't send. And for 4 months, I was waiting for my publishers to get back. And then it turned out it was in drafts, right? Brilliant. In the meantime, brilliant. I made this writing course just to pass the time, right? And I've had hundreds of people write to me saying they hadn't written for months, they hadn't written for years, and suddenly they could write. And I'm not saying that just to big myself up, because it's not me, it's them. But I'm saying anyone can do this. And it doesn't matter if you have been blocked for, I've had people who've been blocked for 25 years. Mm. So my first exercise I do is you set a timer for 10 minutes and you just list made up names.
Mm.
Like kind of like Joe Bloggs, Philip Smith, Francis Dogg. You just start making them up, right? Yeah. The brain is so good at solving problems when you set it specific problems.
Yeah.
Write a novel is not a problem your brain can solve.
No.
Give me 20 names. And it's easier, paradoxically, to come up with 80 ideas than it is to come up with one. Because there's a pressure when you come up with a single idea that it's got to be good.
This is great. This is my good idea.
When you write 80, 79 of those can be, you're going to have to throw out because you only need one name, right? Yeah. So then it's easy and it switches off that response. So that's number one. That's number one and two. Very short timed exercises. Only do 3 minutes a day to start with.
Yeah.
And don't do it every day. Give yourself one day off. Give yourself two. Hell, as long as you're doing it at least 4 times a week, you're going to be changing the patterns in your brain. I spoke to Martin Lotzer, a German neuroscientist, who's shown that the brains of writers and non-writers are wired differently, different parts, different hemispheres. Whole different hemispheres light up in people who write regularly to people who don't write regularly. So and you don't have to do it. The entrainment can be 3 minutes a day for 4 days out of 7 a week, right? So know that you're changing that brain. What fires together, wires together. The second thing is, what's my next action? And that doesn't matter if you're a writer. It doesn't matter if you're trying to do like exercise. It's helped. See, doing this writing thing has mean I now run 18K a week. I was doing nothing, right?
Yeah.
I run 18K a week. I do high intensity interval training 3 times a week. The reason I can do that is because of practicing with writing.
Yeah.
I now realized that what I needed to do it was put my running kit in a plastic bag on my door handle. That's all it took. Didn't need any willpower. I just had to know where it was so there couldn't be a delay from me going, shall I do it now? And going, oh, there it is. And I put it on and I'm gone. Like it wasn't difficult, right? Because I'm not going, I need to do this big run. So the final thing I'm going to suggest is studies in research. And some people may have heard this, but Vipassana meditation, like insight meditation, like following the breath, like meditating for 15 minutes a day. Studies have shown over 8 weeks that it shrinks the amygdala volume in procrastinators. It actually changes the wiring of that brain, and it increases the wiring of, I want to say, the frontal cortex, which is to do with executive control, your ability to make decisions, your ability to have control over those kind of like impulses. So if you are able to meditate for, I wouldn't, you know, don't get obsessed by it. If you can do 3 minutes a day of just sitting and breathing in and out and just concentrating on your breath, and whenever a thought comes up, just let it go. That has been shown to drastically shrink amygdala volume, change the kind of like wiring of of your brain. If you're doing that alongside 3 minutes of writing most days a week over 8 weeks, and that, which is a crazily short time compared to what we used to think in terms of neuroplasticity, the brain becoming kind of like, you know, when I studied psychology back in the 90s, we were told that like the brain, like intelligence and brain structure, becomes crystallized around sort of 35, 40, and then that is it. Yeah. So you better get it locked in, because then you're just like dealing with it and moving around it. Yeah. It's not true. And so we are in this amazing state now where you can, through a few of these things, and by changing that brain, it's not just going to affect writing. This is the amazing thing, is it's allowed me to exercise more. It's allowed me to, you know, just send email instead of putting off. I used to put off sending an email to someone saying, do you want to do this thing, for weeks, months.
Yeah.
And now I just go, what's my next action? I will write the email. I won't send it. That's the thing I tell myself.
Because I think the key there as well is the beauty of that whole system is it's doing exactly as you were saying earlier. If it's turning off your inner critic, it's making every action a positive rather than looking at the actions you didn't take. And I think, again, it's weird. It's not weird at all. I relate it to exercise. The difference I made was I built a little gym at my house. And again, it was exactly that. It's like, if I can get 10 minutes in, great. I'm not going to be beating myself up that I didn't do an hour today. I'm going to be pleased with myself that I did 10 minutes today. And it's a similar thing there of rather than going, oh, you failed because you didn't write 2,000 words. It's like you did your 3 minutes or you did your 10 minutes or you did this.
And it adds up, like it adds up wickedly. I like, you know, like the big game changers for me was like, here's what's my next action. Buy a pen.
Yeah.
Good. Like, I went down the corner shop and I bought a pad and I bought a pen, and it is near, I have one near my bed and I have one on my desk, and that makes it easy to pick up, right? And then you note these things down, and then it is, I've filled notebooks now and I've looked back and some of that stuff is good. I'm writing one novel. I'm like 55,000 words in, but at the same time I've got multiple short stories on the go. I've got three other novels waiting in a holding pattern. I don't want to sound like Scrooge on Christmas Day, but you've got to understand, for someone who basically thought he would never be able to write again because of how anxiety affects him, this is transformed my life. And I'm saying is try it for like a couple of days if you're interested, because like we said all the way through, it's not about, you know, like, it's great if you can share a novel, share a story with people, inspire them, get them reading, you know, whether it's like an exciting novel and they get to sit with that while they're waiting on difficult test results at a hospital and it gives them a little bit of escape, whether you're writing like a deep artistic novel that like moves the genre forward, whatever you want to write, whether you write, you know, like great romance novels that just make people go, oh my God, this is so hot, whatever you want to write, that's cool. And it's wonderful if you get it out there, but your primary audience should be you. And I love what you were saying about like doing your first album. It seems to me like part of what you was like driving you was like, oh my God, we just get to be a bit mischievous,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we get to do our thing.
And writing for mischief rather than to sort of please an imaginary audience is what's going to get you, it's what's going to get you through it. And it's going to make, I want the process to be a joy for people, not just the result. I don't want to say like you walk through fire and you might get like a book.
Yeah.
You might get a book deal at the end of it. Like once that book is over, you can't play with those characters anymore. They're gone. So enjoy it while it's there.
I love that. And is there anything more rewarding than when the tasks set turn from being something that you have to complete to something that you can't make yourself stop? So that 10 minutes thing, I've had ones before where I've struggled to get an hour's writing in a day, and then one day it all clicks and I'm just like, cancelling plans, because I'm just like, it's all coming, it's here now. It's that beauty of what was once a chore. I'm then excited to wake up early and start on it again, you know, because what was once, I need to get this amount done, I need to get this in, then it's like, I just need more time to be.
It's like when you
lock joy when that it's switched and you get to run with it.
Exactly. It's like when you lock in those first four bars
and
you've got like basically what this piece is going to be about
and
you've got the rhyme scheme down, and then it's like just, it's like playing Tetris. You're just slotting stuff in going, oh, I could do this, I could do this, and you're overproducing and you don't mind if you're going to like cut this verse. It doesn't matter. It's just like mischief, and you feel like a little mad professor, like putting stuff together.
Yeah.
And that joy is what I see my daughter doing when she'll like She, at the moment, she's obsessed with making birthday cards for people. And it's not their birthdays. Yeah. She'll just go, she'll just like grab me and go, I'm going to make you a birthday card.
Oh, this and should be more of that.
And she loves it. And she loves making them and she loves the colours. And there's no reason why that, you know, they call it, you know, flow state, but that feeling of like being in the brain's focused mode, where instead of being focused on these ruminating thoughts and threats, you're focusing outwards on something that absorbs you utterly. I think that is one of the high points of being alive.
Yeah. And your daughter is completely on to something there, because I'm not that into birthdays, but it's because birthdays are 364 days in the making.
Yeah.
Like they should be celebrated each time you've got through. Yeah. Like, you don't get to it like that. You get to it through 364 shit days. So yeah. I love that. It's like, happy birthday again. Yeah. You're doing good. You're getting there. That should be a more regular thing. So, where can people find you on socials, and even more importantly, get your 8-week free kind of course and all
cool.
that kind of thing?
Well, if people can follow me on at Tim Clare Poet on Twitter. I've also got my website, www. You never need to say that, do you? People understand. I don't know why we're still going.
HTTPS.
All you need to do is like open an internet browser, right, first. You'll need connectivity to your Wi-Fi. TimClarePoet.co.uk.
And
if you go
it's
on there.
C-L-A-R-E.
That's right, yeah. If you also just Google the Couch to 80K Writing Bootcamp, that's my free, like, 8-week bi-podcast course that's just, like, you can just try out the first one. Over, like, 1,000 people have, like, done the full 8 weeks now, and you can just listen, and every episode is just, all it asks for you is 10 minutes of writing, and it's got the timer in the episode, so you just press play and have something to write on.
Brilliant.
And it will just take you through to the end, and then once it's done, you're done. And, you know, I just hope people enjoy that, because I think making that was about me healing my relationship with writing. And now I'm like the crazy guy who goes around going, I'm really enjoying writing.
I love it. And it's perfect. This has been an absolute joy, because we've talked about you coming on at some point for a while now. And I always feel all these things, it's about timing, man. And this feels like the perfect timing that you're in that hyped, excited place about it all, that we can... It hasn't just been a... Because I had loads of notes about the spoken word scene and the changes, but no one needs to hear just two blokes reminiscing. It's far more exciting to have his stuff that's exciting and new and all that. So, yeah, it's been an absolute joy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim Clare.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. I mean, I told you it was a good one, and I told you it went deep and it was emotional. Obviously, I was also pleased at the start to talk about ice cold showers, because I love that. But yeah, as I mentioned, I'm not going to do a long outro either. I'm just going to be brief and say, look, if you can share this, as said, I'm doing a thing. It's for another podcast I'm guesting on, a BBC thing. And I have to have a week where I don't go on socials. So, yeah, as I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm probably going to pop on or send someone else on or use a Hootsuite or something to post about it once on the day of release. But I won't be there to reply, and like things like Facebook or Twitter, the more I reply and the more I like tweets, the more people see them. I'm not going to be there to do all that, so I really need you guys to go on the Instagram, for example, and like it and comment and leave your thoughts and share it on Twitter, retweet, quote retweets, so you can write a bit at the top to say, look, I enjoyed this episode. On Facebook, share it with your friends and family and so on and so forth. So yeah, get this one out there, guys. I think it's a really good one, and I think there's a lot of people out there who need to hear this at the moment. So, yeah, that is it. I'll be back on Sunday with another special one, to be fair. It's a special... It's Emmy Awareness Day on Sunday, the 12th, May 12th. So I've got Jason Reed on, and we're going to be talking about that. All right, I'll see you in a bit. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.